Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. I was going to say happy Wednesday, but happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome to our monthly webinar where we share market updates, case studies, and really open up the floor to you guys to ask any questions you might have about us or our offering. So just a little bit of recap. If this is your first webinar, first time joining us today, welcome. We are Seveny Investments. Chris and I are co-founders here at Seveny. And we run a mortgage note fund that invests in first position, performing and non-performing mortgage notes, which are secured by single family homes throughout the US. And that was a mouthful. So in short, if I could see your faces, I would probably ask you guys to raise your hand and tell me if you've ever owned a mortgage or had a mortgage before or know what a mortgage is. And if you have owned a mortgage, I would ask you, have you ever received a letter in the mail that said, hey, now you're going to make your mortgage payments instead of Chase Bank, you're going to make them to Union Bank. So if we are the people that essentially are purchasing mortgages, now the biggest difference is we are investing in both performing, meaning people who are consistently paying on time as expected for the terms of their loan agreement, and then non-performing, meaning anyone who is 90 plus days delinquent for whatever reason. So that's at a high level what we do. We have several other webinars on our website that you can reference that really go into a deep dive of every aspect of the business, our acquisition process, due diligence, our fund, how we got into this. But today we really want to keep it about this one case study and give a little bit of a market update. Chris, do you have anything to add before I go on?
No, I think you've said a lot about that. One of the things I just want to kind of reiterate about these webinars, like you mentioned, we do these every month and we want to try and make them as educational and informational as possible. One of the things that we really focus on is that communication and outreach with our current investors or potential investors to be able to answer the questions that they have and that they bring forward to us.
So here at Seveny, we have done over 500 deals and are currently raising capital for a Regulation A Plus offering that has a minimum investment of $2,500 with bonus shares starting at $25,000 with 8 to 11% annually paid as monthly dividends. This is not our first rodeo. We have done previous offerings that have gone full cycle and on those delivered an average weighted IRR of 14.5% to our investors. Now, let's talk about, so that's a little bit about us, our track record, our history. Now, I kind of want to pivot a little bit to questions that I've been fielding, I'm sure Chris has been fielding, about bank failures, the state of the economy affecting this business. So we are continuing to see bank failures, started with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature, and then more recently with First Republic. I think a common misconception that I'm hearing is that this is bad for our fund, our asset class, our market, which is definitely not the case. So kind of to break it down a little bit, when we'll go to Silicon Valley, because again, it's kind of where it all started. When banks have assets that are on their books that are at 3%, that is less valuable than a loan at 6%. So what they're doing is they're losing money. So they're writing down to market value those loans. And then they're really faced with two options. Are we going to manage this asset through foreclosure, which I think most people would think, oh my gosh, if I'm not paying or we're going to go through foreclosure with this, the bank's going to take my home. Contrary to popular belief, banks are not in the business of asset management. They are in the business of creating debt. So for them, that's option number one. I can go through the disposition of this, take this asset for my non-performing loan through foreclosure, that would probably cost them a ton in legal fees, would cost them a ton in legal fees, as well as time. We're looking at minimum of 1 to 2 years plus. And then the other option is to sell these loans at a discount. And that is one, much quicker, and two, allows them to take the money that they got from that sale and create new paper at 6%. So really what we're seeing now is with the interest rates continuing to rise, we're going to see additional stress being put on these banks, which is going to continue to provide us opportunity down the line, more inventory, better pricing. So Chris, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah. Thanks, Lauren. Great explanation. First off, like you mentioned, these banks, it's almost like a going out of business sale of a store, and where people who go buy that product and then turn around and manage it to sell it or keep it, and you're buying it at a discount. But one of the things I just kind of want to mention, like you talked about those banks that have already started to falter, is the banking industry in real estate is always a lagging indicator compared to the stock market. The stock market can be volatile on a daily basis, or something that happens yesterday can impact the market today. That's not the case in real estate. So a lot of people keep asking, is there a crash or what's coming? Again, nobody has a crystal ball or the magic eight ball to predict what is going to happen. There's a lot of things coming out about commercial real estate that can have an impact on banks. But from us, I'm an engineer, for people who don't know. So I like data. I like numbers, and Lauren knows this. So we analyze a lot of the data that comes in. And we have seen already this quarter, which we're in the second quarter of this year, twice as much product for sale than we saw in either of the past two quarters. Or another way is, we've seen so much in the first 6 weeks of this quarter as we saw in the past two quarters for assets to sale. I'll say the bid to ask spread, meaning what the sellers want versus what investors are looking to pay for, is in some instances off a little bit because of the added inventory. Some of that pricing on the distressed product is coming down slightly. It's not coming down significantly, but it's starting to move the needle to go from a seller's market to buyer's market. So we're clearly starting to see some of the impacts already of what's going on in the banking industry with credit tightening and the lending on our end, because we are the front line of this, because most people in real estate might want to get a loan and see that they can or can't. We are the front line because we're buying that from the bank. So we usually have the most up-to-date information.
Chris, and I know this is probably going to be a question we get. I think I actually saw it already dropped in there. So while we're here, before we get into the case study, which actually is on a performing note, so kind of ties in well, why would a bank sell a performing mortgage?
Yeah, great question. We get that asked all the time. And there's many different reasons, whether it's a bank, a hedge fund, a whole loan trader. Several could be it doesn't fit in their portfolio. And what I mean by that is, most loans don't trade a one-off loan. Most of them get sold in tranches of 10, 100, 1,000 loans. And the larger the tranche, the bigger the breakup that firm that bought it will do. They'll go, because they're forced to buy 1,000. So they're forced to buy a lot. They'll take an A tranche, okay, here's the ones we want to keep. Here's what we can manage based off of our staff. And there's, you know, additional tranches that they will then turn around and look to sell off to other investors. And when you're buying loans in bulk like that, you get a significant discount. And as you sell them downstream to investors, you can make profits because of, like anything, it's like buying at Costco versus buying at a 7-Eleven. You're going to get it cheaper at Costco because of bulk. So that's one. Or it could be, like I said, they bought in bulk. It might be a state that they're not interested in. We bought a lot of performing loans from funds that are closing out. Especially towards the end of the year, we see significant inventory because funds want to close out. They want to get those off their books. So a lot of those managers can get their fees or bonuses that they have at the end of the year based on how many loans they sold. But those are just several of the reasons.
So kind of flowing right into our case study, which is on a performing, because we talk a lot about non-performing, but we get that question a lot, like, why would anyone ever sell a performing note? So we're actually going to do a case study on a performing note and walk through this for you. So on the right, you'll see kind of the stats, and I'll let Chris go ahead and kind of walk through this because this is a loan you worked on individually. So go ahead.
Thank you, Lauren. So back to answer, why did this one get sold? This was their closing out of fund. And this fund was closing out and they had several loans left. And this was one that we were able to cherry pick and grab. The balance, or UPB is the unpaid principal balance, was just under $125,000. So that's how much they owed. Property itself was about $500,000 value. And Lauren can talk a little bit later about our investment strategy of the balance versus the value. Principal and interest payments, or monthly payment, was a little bit under $600. The loan status, this was a performing loan. We bought this loan at $80,000, roughly 67 cents on the dollar on the performing side. And one of the reasons why it was discounted is because of the interest rate on the loan to give it the yield that we target, which is in double digits, to make sure we have coverage ratio to cover our costs and the investors. So this is also a fund that they were looking to try and close this out ASAP. We had bought over 100 loans from this fund. And I can't emphasize the importance of relationships in this industry. For the people who are on this webinar, many may not even heard of note investing before us. So it's such a small niche market, and there's not a lot of people in the space, a lot of companies, but you really need to build that relationship, because it's not something that everyone just walks down the street and advertises that they do.
And before you go on, I'll add to that point before you talk about the details of the case study. But a lot of people will say, well, this sounds great. Why can't I do this on my own? I will speak from personal experience. Like Chris said, it really is the relationships, and you have to build out your team, your systems, your processes. If you're investing in more than one state, you need to have your attorneys in every state that you work with, your vendors in every state. So having gone through that individual investor, built my own portfolio, you can be successful, but definitely it's not something that is for the faint of heart or considered mailbox money.
It's interesting because the mortgage market's what, $13 trillion industry with anywhere from 250 to 500 billion in distressed debt just on residential. So it is a huge industry that is out there, but a lot of people don't know about it. You want to say something, Lauren?
No. I was looking at see if there was any questions that are coming in, kind of tied in.
When we were doing our due diligence on this asset after we got under agreement, so we get to see what's called the servicing notes, which are the conversations back and forth between the borrower and the seller. This loan at one point in time was non-performing, and the borrower did get it re-performing on this and had been paying for several years. And in the notes, essentially, the borrower was a woman who was living by herself now. And this is a 2,400 square foot house. And it's got the deck and stuff, as you can see on the outside. But she had outgrown the home. She wanted to downsize the property. So she went and renovated the property, and it had been sitting on the market for a period of time from that standpoint. So when we actually acquired the loan was also listed for sale. And if the borrower were to sell that property, of course, then when you sell a property, the first thing that happens is you pay off your mortgage. So we acquired this. And when we ran our models, basically, we typically hold loans for 2 to 3 year period of time. And this one basically had the target was for us, worst case is if we don't get paid off in 4 years, we could sell it and still have the coverage to pay investors and ourselves in that fashion. But lo and behold, last month, the borrower paid off the loan. So the loan got paid off. We had received since we bought it, you know, the monthly payments on the loan, then the $122,000 check came in. So at the end of the day, because it was performing, we have minimal costs. We only had $600 of additional cost in the loan, which a non-performing loan can have $5,000 to $10,000 plus. But on a performing loan, it's minimal cost. So lower aspect of risk from that. So at the end of the day, in that 6 month period of time, this performing loan netted us close to $45,000 in profit from that strategy. And one of the things we do like about performing loans is historically, the average time somebody lives in a house or refinances is under 7 years. And that number is fluctuated. It's going to continue to fluctuate based on today's rates. But historically, which is what we like to look at, not, you know, also periods of time, it's 7 years from that standpoint. So it's another avenue of on the performing loans. A lot of times nobody has a 30-year, stays in that property for 30 years. But in this one, we had modeled it even at 4 years. So you can see it's not only non-performing loans that can provide that incentive or that kicker. It also can happen on performing loans, which is what we wanted to focus on today.
So with that, I see some questions that have come in. So I'm going to start going through those. If you have any questions about who we are, what we do. And I will leave the offering terms up here because typically a lot of the questions are around this. So again, if you have any questions, drop them in the Q&A and we will start going through those. So you already answered the question about performing. How much will a downturn bank consolidations affect selling performing mortgages?
We don't typically sell our loans back to the banks. They usually will get sold off to hedge funds. Insurance companies are a huge buyer of performing loans, and they will buy millions to billions of dollars in performing loans. We have a relationship with an insurance company that will buy starting at $500,000 of performing loans up to basically infinity. So we've already built that relationship in the past, knowing that we're raising the money. We will want to get these non-performing loans performing. That's just one avenue to sell to, and other investors. There's a lot of other investors out there who want to hold loans themselves, and they can they'll buy performing loans as well.
I'll add to that. And there are other funds who only do performing.
Yes. Most funds only do performing.
Yeah. What's your average cost of expenses once you bought the discount loan from the bank to create the note? So we're not creating or originating notes. And I think, Chris, you just mentioned this. The cost for a non-performing can be $5,000 to $10,000. Now that spread is really dependent on, or it could be less as well. Just depends on one, how long is it before we get them re-performing? Or if we go to foreclosure, those costs are obviously greater on the like higher end of that scale. And then really how much time does it take? So again, it's really how much time and what is that exit strategy? If it's something where the borrower comes to the table and says, hey, this is what happened, this is what I can pay, and we work something out rather quickly, that's very different from someone from a property that ends up being vacant and we have to go through the full foreclosure process.
It really varies state by state because each state has different costs, different laws, different hold times. So when we model everything, it's modeled based off of each state.
Yeah. And I think that's an important note. So when we're going through our due diligence process in order to bid on assets or give indicative bids, we are looking at adding those costs into it. Again, and it varies state by state, which we take into account, and different exit strategies. So we really model it in 10 different ways before we're making a solid indicative bid on something.
Speaking of indicative bid, Jeffrey asked a question about offering below asking price and bid price. You want to give people kind of a little bit of a rundown of how the process works of indicative bid and
Yeah. Talk
through to answer that question?
Yeah. So essentially, it's not something where we receive it's called a tape, which is basically a glorified Excel spreadsheet of assets with all the information from the seller. And we bid and it's like, okay, great. That's what you're bidding. Let's like close. Here's the wire. Wire me the funds. It really is a tape will go out. They will say, if it goes out on Monday, they will say you have till Friday or the following Friday. Usually it's anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks to make your indicative bid. And that is really taking the information that the seller has given you on this tape, the values, the legal, where it is in the legal process, the how many days delinquent, all the information on the borrower, everything, taking their essentially word on it and saying, okay, which ones fit my portfolio? Here's what I would offer on these. Now, then the seller reviews their bids. They say, great, we're going to accept your bid, or hey, we're going to counter. It's very similar to buying a house in the escrow period, because then say they accept your bid, you enter into a due diligence, i.e. escrow period, where you are able to then go and do your own research to validate everything that they've given you. So is title clean? Is the value correct? Is the stated value correct? And this is where those vendors and relationships come into play. So having attorneys that can in each state, or more than one in our case, who can review title, having people set up to go check on the property to make sure that it is, in fact, the picture that they presented in the tape and not a house next door that doesn't look nearly as nice. So we do a lot of validation and due diligence there. And then once we do all of that, if everything lines up and there's nothing that kind of where a first position is actually a third position, or the loan is non-performing and it's actually non-performing, we will continue and close. If there's things that we find that we're not able to fix or are completely off, the value is a big one. If the value's significantly lower, then we will lower our bid or pull that bid from that specific loan and then continue through to close with the rest. So it's definitely a process. It's something that is done overnight. And that due diligence period is anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks.
Somebody asked a question about writing a book about this whole process that you'd have to go through and the team and stuff. Problem is, for me to write a book, it would be about 7,000 pages because I can't shut up and I get too detailed on things. But someone would kill me if I took the time now to write a book.
Yeah, but I mean, there are many books out there that kind of, but none really go into, I will say, again, having started in this industry as someone who built their own portfolio, none of the books really do it justice and tell you all the nitty gritty things and detailed things that go into it. So it probably, like Chris said, would have to be like a 500 page book because there's so many aspects that are not covered. Everything's really high level. Like what I just explained to you even is very high level in terms of like the actual due diligence process. So,
or we have about 150 podcast episodes that we have that our podcast, Creating Wealth Simplified, originally started as the Good Deeds Note Investing podcast, which at the time was really my journey into note investing, where it was sharing the case studies, the stories, and the lessons learned. Because like Lauren said, all the books out there, they're just a real high level of what is note investing. And there's a very big difference between knowing what it is and actually how to do it. Exactly. If you read a book on the MBA, it doesn't qualify you. I like to use the analogy actually as well of, because many of us are golfers, of you can watch somebody or read a book on how to hit off the tee, but the moment you get up there and swing that club, it is a completely different animal. And it's just like playing golf. After that first swing, you take that next one and continue to adjust your swing in your game. So that's an analogy we've used a lot in the past.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly, with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@7einvestments.com to learn more. Thank you.
Are there any legal ramifications against the seller for providing deceitful or erroneous information, or is it buyer beware? So I'm assuming you're talking about before the due diligence process. It's not necessarily something that is done like in a deceitful way. It could be that the data is a few months old. It could be that their last title, it's really that the data is a few months old would probably be it, if anything, because the things that we would find would be something on, we order a new title report. Mm-hmm. When we go into that due diligence period, maybe their last one was a few months ago or didn't find what our attorney found. So it's not necessarily like a deceitful way of doing it. It's just more dated information. And as you can imagine with housing values, we really want the most like current value when we're making our bid, as that is a heavily weighted factor.
Two things I'll mention to that. One, trust but verify. You know, we take the information we're given and that's how we determine our number, but we also verify that other information. Second component to that is we have a very tight locked contract with the seller. And if there was something deceitful, like they had a backdoor deal or they didn't own the asset or something along those lines, we are protected through the contract in many things that are happening. Like if there was a document that had already been signed, knocking $10,000 off the balance of the loan and was not provided to us. Yeah, that would be a contractual, be remediated through the contract to get resolved. But we've bought, like I said, over 500-600 of these assets, and we've never had to litigate anything based off of a contract dispute.
So I love this question. If the housing market takes a hit, how much downside protection is there in the fund? So I was just going to talk about, there's really loan to value and then there's investment to value. So the loan to value is the UPB. So here is 123 over the asset value 500. So there's that loan to value, which is something we definitely look at when we are making our bids. It's why verifying the values of the home is so important. But the investment to value is really the investor's coverage. So you're looking at the acquisition cost, that $80,000 to the asset value of $500. So for this to become a, I guess, issue where investors didn't have protection, you can see that value would have to drop. If that value dropped
80%,
there would probably be something much more catastrophic happening in the world, is what we like to say. Again, not out of the realm of possibility. You don't know what you don't know until it happens. But right now, our current portfolio has an investment to value of 18%. And our loan to value of our entire portfolio is 23%. So just to give you an idea of the coverage we have for and protection for our investors and the assets.
Yeah. Add on to that, a few things are do's and don'ts, essentially. Our don'ts is we don't originate new loans based off of today's values or even post-COVID values. We have not bought any loans on first position residential mortgages that were originated post-COVID. So most of the loans that we buy were originated 2000, 2006, 2010, 2012. So back in those times, somebody was getting a loan on a $200,000 property. Say they put 10% down, which is $20,000, $180,000. Well, they paid some of that mortgage down, but they also got the appreciation value of the home as well during that time. I think that's a very important thing that we focus on is making sure the loans have some seasoning or they're older loans because they'll get that equity bump on them. And like Lauren said, our investment or loan to value is significantly, it's very, very low. And, we like to try and keep that number below 30 or 40% for protecting the investors' funds.
So two questions really quick. I want to answer this one because it's pretty short. Whenever you use the word seller, you are referring to a bank or broker, whole loan trader, correct? Yes.
Yeah, someone we're buying, selling us the loan. Yes.
So the bonus structure, someone asked about this, and I think this is really important. It's always something when people ask me, am I missing something? Is there something I am not asking? So the bonus structure is calculated on an individual investment basis. It's not cumulative. So meaning those bonus shares start at $25,000. If you invested 15 today and 10 next month, you would not be eligible for bonus shares. It is on a individual investment that those are awarded. Will the bonus distribution be a rarity in your estimation? Is the 8 to 11% return a conservative number? We do have certain targets that we hit for the portfolio. If we exceed those targets, there's potential for an additional bonus distribution. It's not something that we are going to commit to. Like every quarter, there will be a bonus distribution. It really depends on the performance of the portfolio in that given quarter.
Like I said, we've been through 5 different funds, some with different structures. And based off of this one having to go through the SEC, we have certain compliance and regulations, what we provide. If there's the opportunity to provide additional distributions to investors, that's something we've done in the past in prior funds as well as this fund. So it's not out of that realm of possible.
In this environment, is your fund more or less profitable? Given interest rates are much higher than when you started the fund, would you consider increasing your payout rate?
So this kind of ties a little bit to what you started out a little earlier about where the market is. The interest rate environment hasn't had an impact. Like I mentioned, it's a very lagging indicator. So it hasn't had significant impact yet on our business. We are starting to see more product come on the market. Like I mentioned, that bid to ask spread is starting to move towards a buyer's side, but it hasn't fully gotten there yet. So there's so many other factors just besides interest rates on a macro scale that can impact a fund and its performance from housing values and many other factors. That one item really doesn't determine whether or not our fund would be more or less profitable from that standpoint. We have to look at everything holistically.
Are there bigger purchase discounts near the end of a month, quarter, or year? Sellers are more motivated to sell to get off the books.
Typically end of year. The slowest time, I'd say, is typically right around tax season for companies trying to get their taxes done. For us, we just had audits. And then summertime, of course, usually slows down a little bit just because of vacations. But post-Labor Day, it's kind of like a marathon towards the end of the year. And that last 60 days is a sprint to the finish.
Yeah. And I think maybe you can speak to, I don't see any other questions come in. So I think it might be good for you to speak to this unless anyone has anything else. Can you talk about what we saw in the first quarter with inventory? And you talked about this a little bit, but maybe go into a little bit more detail. what we saw with inventory in the first quarter compared to now, how many bids we've placed in the last week, month. I know I'm putting you on the spot here. We do have all the data. So.
Yeah, I usually have it popped up on one of my screens here. Typically, we see around, call it $300 to $400 million a quarter in loan sales. So far this quarter, we've seen about $800 million come through the door. What we're seeing a lot of are loans that are, we're going to call, they call them scratch and dent. And give a little bit of understanding how the process works with a lot of lenders and banks is they originate a loan, they collect a fee for originating that loan, and then they usually turn around and sell it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which are called GSEs, government-sponsored entities. And they get their money back and they go issue another loan, so they keep collecting those fees. Scratch and dent loans are loans where borrowers incorrect information, falsified information, or just didn't qualify based on the government. And previously, a lot of those banks would just hold on to those assets. But like Lauren said, these were ones that originated a year ago at 3%, and now they don't know what to do with them. But now they're pushing them out to the market and already starting to trade those. And those, as an example, last year were trading at about 85 cents on the dollar. Now they're below 80 cents on the dollar for where those are trading. So we're seeing a lot of loans like that, a lot of some second loans for people who took out equity lines. And of course, we're still seeing significant aspects of non-performing loans as well. Just this week, we've received over $100 million just come through the door on non-performing loans from people we bought from in the past. So, you know, we're definitely starting to like continue to reiterate, see a uptick in the inventory in the market.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing there is obviously simple supply and demand. The more inventory we're seeing, the more the pricing is going to soften in our favor and turn to be a buyer's market. We're already starting to see that, but even more so, I anticipate that will continue to happen in the coming months. I got another question. Can I invest in your fund through my broker? And if so, do I get the same benefits? The answer to that is yes, you can. And yes, you get the same benefits as someone who is investing directly online. Wow. Okay, we got through them all in like the 30-ish minutes. Yes.
There's one other one where Tom asked a question. It's more real estate related, but I just can't help myself answering real estate questions. Owns a couple of single family rentals. Is there a way to get notes on these properties and stop renting them? Tom, there's something you could do where you could do what's called seller financing. So you could find a buyer for those properties and act as the bank and issue a loan to that buyer. That is something that we hear the phrase a lot, tired landlords, of people who have owned rentals for a period of time and get worn out by tenants and maintaining them or complaints, and rather be what we like to use the term lean lord versus landlord. So when the toilet breaks at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday or is flooded, you don't get the call as the lender, they call the owner of the property. That's one thing. And if you want to hit me up offline, happy to give you some direction on where you can find information on that.
So again, we are raising capital for our Regulation A Plus offering. It's open to accredited and non-accredited investors alike. The minimum investment is $2,500. Those bonus shares start at $25,000 and it's 8% plus, again, kind of giving in bonus shares, pay annually, paid monthly as dividends. So if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. If you go to the next page, it'll have our contact information. You can reach out to Invest at 70 Investments. There is my contact information, my direct line as well, or find us on our website, invest.70investments.com. Thank you all so much for joining us today. And again, reach out if you have any questions.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.